We are in the book of Daniel, chapter 9. I want you to turn there and go to the 25th and 26th verses, please. To those who just tuned in, I said rather humorously, the Pope wears a robe with shoulder pieces like this, and he wears a hat. Why is it he can dress unusual and nobody gives a comment? I've been spoiling you folks here downtown, being so clerically dressed all the time. I do that just because it makes my enemies mad to find out that I am entitled to dress that way. But once or twice a year, I dress my way. Know therefore and understand. That's the 25th verse, back up to the 24th. An angel is talking to Daniel. 70 weeks are determined upon thy people and upon thy holy city. That makes the message very clear. Thy people, he was a Jew, thy city, Jerusalem. Now, Daniel's prophecies have spanned the history of the nations. In Daniel 11, we traced a history of a narrow focus in the globe in the Middle East, with the kings of the north, the Syrian kings, the Seleucid descendants, the Ptolemies, the Egyptian descendants. We traced in the earlier visions the history of the nations that flow out of the Babylonian Empire, their conquerors, the Medo-Persians, and their conquerors, the Greeks, and their conqueror, the Roman Empire, and then leaping across the gap of thousands of years to the final 10 kingdoms, to the little horn that is Antichrist. We identified him in placement in Daniel 11, a successor to the area kingdom of the Seleucids, centered in Iraq, but including western Iran, southern Turkey, Syria, Transjordan, and Lebanon. And from that place will come Antichrist, identified as the King of the North. Now, in this 9th chapter, the angel concentrates on thy people, speaking to Daniel, a Jew, thy city, Jerusalem. And the prophecy in the mouth of the angel says, 70 weeks. Again, this would better read 77s. It's hard for us in the English language to realize that the word week used to translate this can mean anything other than 7 days. But the word in the Hebrew has its meaning determined by the context, and it literally translates 77s. 77s are determined upon thy people and upon thy holy city. And whisper a prayer for me, because I'm sort of wavery physically. But God's never failed me yet as I get into the message, that strength will come. But whisper a prayer, if you will, please. 77s are determined upon thy people and upon thy holy city. Literally 70 weeks of years. Because the sevens referred to are obviously years. To finish the transgression, to make an end of sins, to make reconciliation for iniquity, to bring in everlasting righteousness, to seal up the vision and prophecy, and to anoint the Most Holy. In the subsequent message, I intend to dissect each of those phrases, but in a period of 490 years, 77s of years, 490 years, God is going to accomplish all of those things just enumerated on the Jew and on the holy city, Jerusalem. Now, I will anticipate where we're going, that these weeks break into three sections. Again, I'll spend more time in a subsequent message showing how this breaks down in the original, but the 77s or 70 weeks of years will then break down into 7, 62, and 1, for a total of 70. And between the 7 and 62, which represents 69 weeks, and the final week of 7 years, is the gap. And I won't even take the time to defend the gap theory today, of thousands of years until God, who at the end of the 69th week turns his attention to other matters, will return in his focus in the 70th week of Daniel, a final 7 years of concentrated attention to finish the things that were enumerated to be accomplished in the 490 years. At the death of Christ, God turned. As Jesus said, he came to his own, and his own received him not. And at the crucifixion of Christ, God will turn his attention to what in Romans 9, 10, and 11 is described by Paul as the grafting on of the wild olive branch onto the trunk of the tree of faith initiated by Abram. Paul sounds a warning to those that comprise the wild olive branch, saying if God could graft on the wild olive branch, the Gentiles, onto this root stock of the faith of Abraham, how much easier he will find it to graft back on once again the original stock. And in that backdrop of warning, you catch the reality that God has turned from that direct stream of Abraham to develop this wild olive branch, which is the church. But a time will come when the church is caught away, and God will then turn again to the natural stock of the root of the tree of Abraham. And in the final 70 years of history as we now know it, the Great Tribulation, which comprises the subject matter of most of the book of Revelation, he will finish what was started and must be completed in a total of 490 years with exact attention on the Jew. Now, it's not unusual. You will find that many of the promises that God gives the Jew are related to the land. It's the Jew in their place of promise. For 490 years, they did not keep the Sabbath years, and God took them out of the land for 70 years in order that for those 70 weeks of years, their failure to keep the Sabbath year every seventh year and let the land lay fallow, God accomplished his purpose by removing them from the land that he might get his Sabbaths back. Now, as Daniel is praying and they're coming to the end of the 70 years bondage and will return again to their land, God says 70 more weeks of years are in my plan when I will accomplish these things just enumerated in that 24th verse. And at the cutting off of Messiah, they begin to lose their land and were scattered and dispersed throughout the world. The final 70 years after the gap of the wild olive branch development, which is the church, will find them once again in their homeland, as they are now with the new state Israel. And having finished with the church that he's redeeming and lifting out of the earth, God then will finish his job with the Jew in a final 7-year program. Now that 70 weeks, as I've said, breaks down into 7 and 62 and 1. Know therefore, verse 25, and understand that from the going forth of the commandment to restore and to build Jerusalem unto the Messiah, the Prince, shall be 7 weeks and 62 weeks, 7 plus 62. And after 62 weeks, difficult translation, but having said there'll be 7 plus 62, then in the style of the original, they reference after that 62 portion, which has already been preceded by 7. Thus, in generic whole, after 69 weeks, though it names here only the 62 second section, after 69 weeks shall Messiah be cut off, but not for himself. Draw a line right there. The next phrase, and the people of the prince that shall come shall destroy the city and the sanctuary, and the end thereof shall be with a flood. And unto the end of the war, desolations are determined. And he, that is the prince that shall come, shall confirm the covenant with many for 1 week. That's the 70th week. And in the midst of the week, he shall cause the sacrifice and the oblation to cease, as he breaks the covenant of 7 years made in this final period of history. And in the middle of the week, the middle of the tribulation, possessed of demons out of the pit, he will break the covenant. And again, in much detail, the book of Revelation deals with that final week. The gap is inserted before the conjunction and. I'll repeat it again so you can write it. After 62 weeks, which has already been preceded by 7. So thus, after 69 weeks, shall Messiah be cut off, but not for himself. He dies for the sins of the world. And the gap intersperses. You skip over thousands of years now before the conjunction. And the people of the prince that shall come, that's not Christ, that's Antichrist. Christ doesn't come to destroy the city. Antichrist suddenly is in focus, shall destroy the city and the sanctuary. Now it is very clear that the countdown of this 69 weeks, the 7 plus the 62, begins from the going forth, verse 25, of the commandment to restore and to build Jerusalem. From the going forth of the commandment to restore and build Jerusalem. That's the starting point. The edict starts with the command to build the city. Or restore it, rebuild, I should say. And the 69 weeks, or 483 years, 69 times 7, will end with Messiah cut off. So you have a 483 time span, 483-year time span, which is the 69 weeks, that has a date certain for starting and an event certain for ending. Follow that? Now, I'm sure it's interesting to study prophecy, whatever the reason, but I teach on prophecy to prove God's control over history, God's ability to carry out His Word, God's demonstrated faithfulness to watch over what He says and do it. And when that is demonstrated, faith is built, because the same word of promise that we preach consistently from this pulpit applied to your life on a daily basis. God watches those promises just as faithfully. I'm claiming it today. I'm the Lord that healeth thee. I will go to the communion table today and take the broken bread and say, with His stripes, I was healed. Every promise in God's book, we can claim with the same certainty that the same God who demonstrates He watches over His Word to do it will watch over His Word of promise to usward. But most of those words of promise are conditional, conditioned upon faith. These promises aren't conditioned on faith. God's going to do it, and He therefore watches His Word to accomplish it. But where faith builds up and we seize a promise, then God, watching that Word, sees our grip on it, and then is invoked His same watching concern to do that Word that He's spoken. That's why I preach on prophecy. Now, this is one of the most astounding tests of God's faithfulness to be found in Scripture. If you can locate the starting point, which is the command to build the city, and count off 483 years, comprising 69 weeks of years, and it comes to the point of the cutting off of Messiah, that's pretty convincing, at least to me, that God's in control, and all the critics of Daniel, even if they were right, which they're not, that this book was not written until 165 B.C., would be confounded by this prophecy that reaches into the first century A.D. and the cutting off of Messiah. Now, I have an overhead projector, if you'll let the screen down back there, fellows. And I'm going to see if I can show you this date certain a little more clearly than my usual scribbles on the board. It's as far as it's going to come. Don't turn lights off till I tell you to. Engineers, I know how to run this show. Until I'm sure it won't work with these lights on, I ain't taking anybody's word for it. Now, let's see if I can get this shown up there. See what happens. Now, what I want, the reason I didn't want you to turn lights off, is I want all the white lights off. Leave the reds and the blues on. Just turn the whites off. Well, I got big white spots up there. Yeah. I'm in the shadows. Leave it alone like that. Well, come back to me. I want to see this. See if I can position it to where the whole thing can be seen on the screen. Now, I can write on this and make it bolder, which I will. Now, turn the red lights off. Just give me blue. I don't like that. I don't like that at all. Turn the blue lights off of the spots and give me the red. Now we're talking. That's fine. All I got to do is find my way around here, and I can demonstrate what I wish to show you today. I appreciate your concern that your pastor was going to be decapitated. And that's just wonderful now, boy. You better not move an eyelash, talk to your neighbor, do anything, because I'll catch you today. I got that. Normally, I got the bright lights on me, and you're in the dark. Now I'm going to find all the culprits that don't show proper respect for God's house today and throw them out on their ear. You better pay attention, because I can see you. See that? I mean, by golly, we've gone fancy overnight. There are four edicts that are given, four commands, and I covered this last Sunday, so most of you have it written in your Bible, and I'm sure not going to go over it again today. There was the edict of Cyrus that let them return to Jerusalem to build the temple. They fell under persecution, and they were ordered to stop. And some 15 years later, under Darius, the books were searched, and the original decree of Cyrus was renewed. That's the second command. Again, it was simply to renew the first command to build the temple. Then Ezra himself receives a commission to go and refurbish the temple, to complete the job of rebuilding and restoring the temple. Only one edict was given to go and build the city. And that's the one recorded in Nehemiah chapter 2. In Nehemiah chapter 1, in the month of November, Chislev, on the Hebrew calendar. November, approximately on our calendar. Nehemiah hears words of the rundown condition of the city of Jerusalem. 4 months later, in the month of Nisan, or the rough equivalent of March on our calendar, he appears before the king with sad countenance. The king asks, "What's the matter?" He then says, "The city is run down," and asks permission to go and rebuild the city and restore the walls. And in Nehemiah 2, in the month of Nisan, in the 20th year of Artaxerxes, the king, he receives the edict to go and rebuild the city. That's the only edict to build the city that's written. And it's in the 20th year of Artaxerxes. Therefore, the date Nisan, which is March, roughly, on our calendar, Nisan, the 20th year of Artaxerxes, is when the edict is given to restore the city. If we can locate that date, we then have come to the starting point of this countdown. You will never be able, let me get this centered right, you will never be able to sort out the starting point. Now, if I walk back this way, you come up and push on me, okay? Now, I need to get a camera that doesn't move around and picks this up for the people at home about the way you had it. Don't worry about my shadow on it, but get a good picture of it because I can see you on the screen. In order to determine for or which particular year this edict in Nisan, or the equivalent of March, occurs, I must take you first through a series of calendars, the Julian calendar. And the important years are 465 to start it, and 464 and 463 B.C. You can check anywhere you want to check, but multiplied sources have Artaxerxes come to power after the death of Xerxes. There was a usurper to the throne for a few months. This is secular history. I'm going to say it. You can check it abundant. And in February, on the Julian calendar, 465 B.C., or rather 464 BC, February, right here, is the date when Artaxerxes first stepped on the throne. Now, the Julian calendar runs from January, February, March, April, May, June, July, August, September, October, November, December. Start the year 464, January, February, March, on to December. Start the year 463, January, February, March, on to December. And you have those year spans, Julian, drawn down through the other calendars so we can see where the other overlaps are. The Persians went by a different calendar. They went from March, Nisan. So on the Persian calendar, the Julian calendar had already run for 2 months and a portion of a month before the Persian New Year starts. Thus, the Persian year from Nisan to Nisan had the months of January and February of 464 included in their year. 10 of the months would be on the Julian 465. The last 2 months, January and February, would be in the Julian year of 464. You follow that? Now, the Jewish calendar begins Tishri, September. Again, the overlap is shown. Already on the Julian calendar in 465, 8 months have run by. The Jewish calendar starts in September. It also, after 4 months, overlaps into 464, so the year starting in 465 for the Jews would have 4 months of the Julian calendar, followed by 8 months into 464. You following that? Now, under the Persian system of accession, when a king came to the throne, if he came to the throne after the year on the particular calendar, counting it, don't get ahead of me, come to me now. That's fine, I don't mind talking like I'm in a hole. We'll get over here. Now you see me. If a king came to power in the mid-year, for example, back to the calendar, if a king came to power in the Persian calendar in October, let's say, then he would, on the Julian equivalent for October, November, December, January, and February, that would be a part of a year. That was called, in their accounting, the accession year, because their first reigning year had to be a whole year. So if they came to power any time during April, May, June, July, August, September, October, November, any period of time less than a year, that was not counted as his first reigning year, it was accession year. Coming to power and sitting on the throne the first time in February of 464 B.C., that meant that Artaxerxes, the king to whom Nehemiah will go, he had an accession year of only 1 month on the Persian calendar. His reigning year, or regnal year, would start right here. And I've written Artaxerxes' first reigning year, Persian, would start March 464 on their calendar, the first year being March to March, overlapping into 463. You follow that? Oh, yeah, wonderful. Isn't that great? Now the problem complicates because the Jews are operating under a separate calendar. The same principles apply. If Artaxerxes came to power during a portion of the year, then Artaxerxes' portion of a year that was the first year he reigned is called the accession year. He came to power in February. Thus, on the Jewish calendar, his accession year would run all the way through August. And his reigning year would start in September, or Tishri, 464, and extend all the way to September 463 as the first reigning year, with February through August being his accession year, on the Jewish calendar. Follow that? Now, if you only live with one calendar, not a problem to them. I mean, the principle is, if you come to power any time during the year after it has started, that first year is called your accession year. Then each full year after the first one, first full year is the first reigning year. So the 20th year of Artaxerxes would in fact be the 20th year starting with the reigning year, 464 March through 463 March, and each year thereafter. On the Jewish calendar, the accession year is said would go to August, and his reigning year would start September 464 through September 463 and run ever after. I've cataloged that over here. You with me now? 464 is his first reigning year, and it wouldn't matter which calendar, the Persian or the Jewish. But depending upon the calendar, the starting point was February, and your reigning year starts accordingly afterwards. So 464, September. Since February coming to the throne through August on the Jewish calendar is his accession year, and I've written there Artaxerxes accession, Jewish. See that? His first reigning year, Artaxerxes' first reignal year, Jewish, starts with September. So starting right here in September 464, his first reigning year, down to 60 is the 5th, down to 455 is the 10th, 454 is the 11th, to 450 is the 15th, to 445 is the 20th, beginning September 445 B.C. to September 444 B.C. is his 20th reigning year. You follow that? Now let's skip up to that 20th reigning year. Oh, I've come back into the light. Am I boring you? A lot of confusion can be eliminated if we take our time on this and can thus move forward from this point. Moving to the 20th year, you can see I had professionals do this. Are you up to the 20th year with me?
Yes, sir.
Do you understand why this is important to find that starting point to determine the date? We have the 20th year starting September 445 through 444 September, correct? His Artaxerxes' 20th year Persian was March 445 to March 444 B.C. And we have it here from March to March. You see that? Overlapping the years 445, 444, and 443, which is Julian. I mean, the Persian didn't say 445 B.C., March through March. They said 20th year of Artaxerxes, starting on Nisan. Jewish, September 445 to September 444 B.C. is his 20th year. Now, one of the things that's confounded the people who read these dates in the book of Nehemiah is in the first chapter of Nehemiah, Nehemiah 1, in the month Kislev, which is November, or the equivalent, 445 B.C., the 20th year, November, and then Nehemiah 2, 4 months later, the edict is in Nisan, which is March 444 B.C., as I'll show you in a moment. What has confused many is we think in terms of Julian, and November does not come before March. You follow that? Now, the opening verse of Nehemiah 1 says, in the month Kislev, Well, the month Kislev is the equivalent of November on our calendars. Now, November, 445, is right here on the Julian calendar. But it's still in the 20th year of Artaxerxes, and still in the 20th year of Artaxerxes on the Jewish calendar. On the Jewish calendar, it's the third month of their year. On the Persian calendar, it's further in. You count it for me. November is the 11th month on the Julian calendar. November is the 9th month, isn't it? 8th or 9th on the Persian calendar. Kislev is the 3rd month on the Jewish calendar. Now, in a Julian calendar, if you said the same year, you couldn't have November come before March because you're going to jump over a year. But in the Persian calendar, you can't have November come before March either. November, March to March is going to cross over November en route to March. So that passage in Nehemiah absolutely confirms that the calendar that is being used is the Tishri to Tishri, because neither one of these allows November to precede March in the same year. You follow that? But Nehemiah makes it clear that he gets the news about the damaged city in November, and 4 months later in March of the same year, Nehemiah 1 says, Kislev, 20th year of Artaxerxes. Nehemiah 2 says, Nisan, 20th year of Artaxerxes. That becomes the clue that tells you it has to be calculated, as quite rightly, because Nehemiah is a Jew, calculated on the Jewish calendar, which runs from Tishri to Tishri, because in the Jewish calendar, September is the first month, October, November is the third month, December is the fourth, January is the fifth, February is the sixth, and March is the seventh month. So on the Jewish calendar, it's quite proper in this, the 20th year of Artaxerxes, that runs from September to September, 445 to 444. We know this edict is calculated on a Jewish calendar, 20th year of Artaxerxes. November, he hears of the mess. March, in the same year, he gets the edict. Thus, we can calculate that the Nisan, therefore, since the Jewish year starts with September 445 and runs through September, or through August, up to September, right here, of 444, he gets the news in B.C. 445, November. You see that on the Julian? But 4 months later, we cross the Julian time zone into the next year, 444, January, February. It's March 444 B.C., that he receives the order to go and build. You follow that? Because here is where they trick you in so many of the books. They interchange without leading by the hand between the calendars, and they say the 20th year of Artaxerxes, using a Persian calendar, is most all in 445 B.C. So because the 20th year in each case starts in 445 B.C., they quickly, and this is what's known as rhetoric, all men have two legs. This has two legs. Therefore, it's a man. No, it's a pigeon. That's rhetoric. Logic says, all men have two legs. This is a man. Therefore, you expect two legs. They'll start out and start writing because they want to prove a point and have Christ die at a certain time that proves their own pet theory. And they will point out that the 20th year of Artaxerxes begins in 445 B.C. We make an immediate mental flip in our brain. If something begins in 445, then it's January. Thus, March of that same year is going to automatically and conveniently, to those who want a different year for Christ's death, be March 445 B.C. No, it isn't. Nehemiah is clearly, to repeat it, on a Tishri calendar, because in the first chapter, he hears the news in November, and in the second chapter, he gets the order to build in March. And only on the Tishri to Tishri calendar does November come before March. On the Julian, March comes before November on the Persian. March starts the year and obviously comes before November. So only this Tishri calendar can be used to interpret this order from God, because Nehemiah is talking from a Tishri calendar, and he says in the 20th year of Artaxerxes on his Tishri calendar, in November he gets news and in March he gets an edict. Thus we have located March 444 B.C. as the departure point for the countdown that brings us to the cutting off of Messiah. Am I boring you? Now I want to do one more thing. You are now with me, and we have calculated that the starting point of the 69 weeks of years is March B.C. 444. Correct? Now we're going to do the countdown on now. You that read the back of the book will be already down to 5. That's okay. Just come back and make the trip with me later. If we take, we now know that it is a Jewish calendar, correct? The Jewish calendar is based on 360-day years. Therefore, the 483 years, which is 69 times 7 times 300, 69 times 7 is 483 years, times 360-day years, comes out to 173,880 days. You can do the calculation or you can take my word for it. That is what God has said must elapse. 69 years on the Jewish calendar of 360 days per year must elapse before Messiah is cut off, not for his sake, but for the sins of the world. You follow that? But we're working on a Julian calendar. The Julian calendar, if we take 444 B.C., March, and solar years, and go to 33 A.D., this is 444 years plus 33 minus 1 equals 476 years. Now, the minus 1 is because nobody ever heard of 0 B.C. or 0 A.D., December 31st, 1 B.C., one day later, January 1st, is 1 A.D., and you've lost a year in between. That's why the minus 1. So if you take the Julian calendar and just start March 444 B.C., which we have determined is on the Jewish calendar, but it's still the same date in history, 444 B.C., Nisan, and go to 33 A.D., same time, Nisan, you're going to have 476 years. But 69 times 7 is 483 years. So that's a 7-year differential. Correct? You follow that? The 7-year differential is confronting us. If you take the Julian calendar and go from 444 B.C. to 33 A.D., Julian, you have 476 years. If you go 69 times 7, you come up to 483 years, correct? Thus, we have a 7-year differential, right? The Julian calendar comes out 7 years short. And that's turned prophecy preachers loose. Because the 7 years that's critical is the final 7 after the gap. And those who do not want to believe that the 7 years is yet future and that the book of Revelations is going to be fulfilled literally as it describes the happenings, they will do this inversion. They'll start at the same date, but they will calculate it through the Julian calendar and come up with that extra 7 years to get everything else done they want done. The problem is you've got to transpose the 360-day year onto the Julian calendar. So 360-day years produce 173,880. Are you with me now? Well, that was pretty weak, yes, sir. Where'd I leave you? I know math is a terrible subject, but stay with me for a minute. Are you following that the Jewish calendar, we established it's the Jewish calendar, Tishri to Tishri, and that Jewish Tishri to Tishri calendar is 360-day years, and they operated on 360-day years. And God said 69 years before the cutting off of Messiah, and that comes 360 days, 69 weeks of years times 360 days comes out 173,880 days. Or just multiply 483 years times 360. You got that figure?
Yes, sir.
You go then to the Julian calendar and you're 7 years short. But you can translate this Julian calendar into days by taking that number 476 times 365.24219879, it's going to equal 173,855 days plus 6 hours, 52 minutes, and 45 seconds. Hey, can I have an amen?
Yeah.
Now, that means the Julian calendar, when we translate it into days, it's not 7 years differential. If you multiply the days, because there are more days per year in the Julian calendar than there are in the Jewish calendar, and over 476 years, those extra days add up quite a lot. So instead of a 7 year differential, when you translate the 476 years that on the Julian calendar runs from 444 BC to 33 AD, and multiply it by the days in the year of the Julian calendar, you come up with 173,855 days, which is 25 days short of the 173,880 needed. Now, most of the scholars make an assumption. Now, you know what happens when you assume, don't you? Most of the scholars assume. And you can see that that makes something out of both you and me. Most of them assume that because Nehemiah in his second chapter says that he receives this edict or goes before the king in the month of Nisan, 20th year of Artaxerxes, which we know is March 444 BC, the scholars assume since he doesn't say what day of the month, it had to be the first. No, it doesn't. God doesn't have to tie his hands that tight. And then here is God sending an angel to bring the answer to prayer to Daniel. And the angel has withstood the demon princes of Persia and is 3 weeks late in delivering the message. God's not going to tie himself down completely. You remember in the New Testament it says concerning Elijah, he prayed earnestly that it wouldn't rain. I preached on it and pointed out, why would a desert man pray that it wouldn't rain? If you're in the balcony, I expect you to listen. I don't miss much. And the balconies of churches through history have become places where casual onlookers sit. No. I don't want any talking. And ushers, you pay attention to your job. I preached on Elijah, and Elijah in the desert prays that it won't rain. Why would a desert man pray that it wouldn't rain? Because back in Deuteronomy, God had said if they ever worshipped idols, he'd shut up the heavens and wouldn't let it rain again. They started worshiping idols with Jeroboam. Generations went by before King Ahab's on the throne and Elijah begins to pray and invoke God's word and at more risk to himself than anybody, prays earnestly that it won't rain, that God's honor and faithfulness to his word might be demonstrated. You see a delay in the fulfillment. All the scripture says is that Christ cannot be crucified. Messiah cannot be cut off till these 69 weeks run. They have to run. Now, if we add the 25 days and assume, I'm going to assume with the scholars, assume that Nisan 1 was the first day of the month, Nisan 1 is the day that Nehemiah got his edict. That's an assumption because Nehemiah doesn't say it could have been any day of Nisan. All he says is in the month of Nisan. But let's assume it's the first day of Nisan. That would be the equivalent of March 4th or 5th. I'll explain why I say 4th or 5th. Astronomically, it's March 4th. But because they use human sightings of the new moon, it usually would fall a day late. And that's why that most scholars will say March 5th, 444 B.C. If March 5th, 444 B.C. is taken as, and I note here, note could be March 4th, etc., etc., etc. But if what the scholars say, Nisan 1 is the starting point of the 360 days, 173,880 days, it's March 5th on the Julian calendar. Then the solar years, 25 days short, reaches March 5th, 33 A.D. You add 25 days. I mean, March 5th's the same. And we've already calculated that there's 173,855 days in the 476 years from 444 to 33 A.D., starting March 5th, ending March 5th. Assuming Nisan first as the starting point, then we're going to reach March 5th, 33 A.D. on the Julian calendar with 173,855 days. You can do it yourself and you'll see it's right. Then add the 25 days shortage. You reach March 30th, 33 A.D. March 30th, 33 A.D., according to McDowell and that Daniel in the Critics' Den, Honer, the Dallas Theological Seminary writer who has calculated dates, and Rutherford, the student of the pyramid, they all conclude March 30th, 33 A.D. brings you to Monday, Nisan the 1st. And by this traditional view, Nisan 14 will occur on Friday, April 3rd, 33 A.D. But there are many questions, which I'm going to go to. Assume the traditions. That means on Monday, March 10th, or Nisan 10 rather, on Monday, March 30th is what that would be, Nisan 10, is when the 483 years runs out. Then on Tuesday, the 11th, Wednesday, the 13th, Thursday, starts the 14th into Passover Day on Friday, according to the traditional view. Now, there are many, many questions. And you can bring up the lights. And let me talk about the questions for a moment before I proceed. And I'll turn this off so we can get all the lights back in and bring today's portion of this to a close. Lift the screen. Have I bored you? By translating the days and transposing onto the Julian calendar, you come to March 30th, 33 A.D. on the Julian calendar. If Nehemiah received the prophecy on the first day of Nisan, that's the biggest if of all. Now, all the traditional scholars want to make it come out to Nisan 14, which is Passover, hitting Friday. Why? Because that's been the traditional time, Good Friday, of Christ's crucifixion through the years. God didn't have to make it conform to this calendar. He just had to have the 476 years on the Julian calendar plus 25 days, or the 483 years on the Jewish calendar pass before Christ was cut off. God already gave in His Word the clue as to when Christ would die. He would die on Passover. So we know it has to be on Nisan 14 that He dies. And if the traditional scholar's viewpoint is correct, that the 69 years ends on Monday, Nisan 10, then Tuesday's Nisan 11, Wednesday's Nisan 12, Thursday, I'm doing it accurately now, is Nisan 13, and Friday's Nisan 14, and they've supported the traditional view. The only problem is they have to sort of twist the scripture and say what I've already said, that Jesus had to die after the 69 weeks. I'm not so sure, though I said it earlier, that room needs to be given to God. I'd rather think that He meant it when He said 69 years will go by and end when Jesus is cut off. That means the 69 years ought to end on Nisan 14. Exactly, on Nisan 14. Now, how did they determine the new year? Assuming the traditional view that Nisan 1 was when Nehemiah, the first day of the month, got his vision, though I've told you that isn't true. All Nehemiah says is Nisan. That means you could therefore take the year 33 A.D., and start with Nisan 14, and go back, and you would come to what day in Nisan it starts. Because all the Bible says is Nisan, 444 B.C. Doesn't say whether it's Nisan 1, Nisan 2, Nisan 3, Nisan 4. And we're only talking a two-day differential between a Wednesday crucifixion and a Friday crucifixion. Well, you'll read these experts, they'll say, modern astronomy has shown there's only once. I mean, AD 27, 30, 33, and 37 are the only years that Nisan 14 occurred on Friday. That doesn't have anything to do with the price of matzo ball in Jerusalem. Because they didn't have modern astronomy. There is a whole book that I was going to put on here, a reference to prove nobody can figure out with any certainty 1,000 years back when on the Jewish calendar they would have the new moon each month. Because the way it was done in the first century, the Mishnah was not translated until recently into English. And in the Mishnah, there are regulations that have to do with the worship and activities around the Second Temple, which was the one built by these people who came back under Ezra and Nehemiah, and was the one standing in the first century when Jesus was crucified. Under those regulations, the Sanhedrin determined when the new moon began the month of Nisan. It began with the first glimpse of the new moon. Now, astronomically, we can determine in the year 33 A.D. exactly when the new moon appeared. But they didn't have astronomical instruments in the first century like we have. And they had them before the pyramid, but not in the first century. The way they determined the new moon, and there was always the possibility of bad weather and spring rains in March, when that first crescent appeared, that's the new moon. Scientifically, we can find it when it ought to have occurred by astronomical non-varying moon risings and settings on charts that we can project backwards to the first century with modern astronomical equipment. But the Sanhedrin asked for two reliable witnesses. Two reliable witnesses had to see the moon. Well, astronomically, it appears so low on the horizon, it usually was one day and 17 hours. They allowed him past the first point of when it should appear to continue to watch. When two reliable witnesses saw the first new moon, they also were allowed a day and a half of travel time to get to the Sanhedrin, because there was no telephone and no fax machine and no satellite to shoot up the picture of the moon. That means you could have a fluctuation of anywhere from 1 to 3 and almost 4 days on either side. The same way back here. Way back in 444 B.C., they could have been off a day or two. And they could have been off a day or two in 33 A.D. The point I make is, all you can be certain of is that the 173,880 days had to pass, which is what the traditional scholars say, before Christ could be crucified. And when those days passed, he had to be crucified after that fact. I have developed such a faith in God, I'm willing to put money now, that God will be right on the button. And we're talking of a lag between a Wednesday, Thursday, or Friday. The three different points of view on scholarship on crucifixion are Wednesday, Thursday, or Friday. And each one of those sets of scholars argue from evidence they can find in history that nights and 10 occurred on Saturday. The other group argue that nights and 10 occurred on Sunday. And the other group, this group, argue that nights and 10 occurred on Monday. Because nights and 10, which ends the 173,880 days, assuming the first of nights and is the starting point, takes you to nights and 10. But the scholars have never agreed whether nights and 10 actually, not astronomically, actually was on Saturday, Sunday, or Monday. And depending upon whether you wanted to die on Wednesday, Thursday, or Friday, you pick the weight of scholarship accordingly. God settles the argument. When in Matthew he says, Jesus must stay in the tomb 3 days and three nights and still rise on the first day. You can't go into the tomb Friday night and rise Sunday morning and have 3 days. And those who have the Friday crucifixion argue that to a Jew, part of a day is a whole day. Not if they're counting money, I'm telling you. Just thought I'd catch you on that one. To a Jew, part of a day is a whole day. Well, if he's buried at sundown on Friday, that ain't even a part of day. Because Saturday starts at sundown. And they have to change to our way of thinking, sunrise to midnight or midnight to midnight. Their day was sundown to sundown. So Saturday was started on Friday at 6 p.m. And Sunday morning doesn't give you the 3 days. The other, no prophecy of scriptures of private interpretation, the other Word of God requirement of 72 hours in the grave to fulfill the type of the unleavened bread and 3 days and three nights as Jonah was in the belly of the whale on the authority of Jesus' own statements drives you to a Wednesday crucifixion, not a Friday crucifixion, and a Saturday evening resurrection, not a Sunday morning resurrection. All these books argue themselves froth-mouthed on their particular point of view. Having said all that, in fairness, you calculate the statistical probability that you could have a prophet in the 6th century B.C. say that 483 years would pass, and the temple, or rather, and the city, and its walls would be built in troublesome times, which is the first 7 week of years, 49 years. And then another 62 weeks of years would pass, totaling 483 years, 173,880 days, and then Messiah would be cut off. To come within 10 days of that, and to be certainly consumed as a length of time prior to Messiah being cut off, you calculate the statistical probability for that. And when you understand that most scholars have calculated it to within 5 days or 4 days of the Friday traditional crucifixion, it comes out directly to Monday, nice and ten, March 30th, if you calculate from nice and one, 444 B.C. That Monday, March 30th, is within 4 days of the April 3rd crucifixion on Friday, which is traditional. When you understand that the sightings could vary 2 days easily on the Nisan 1 date that starts the clock, then those 2 days could have made the 173,880 days land right dead center on Monday, on Wednesday. And Christ then would be crucified on April 1st. And what a background for April Fool's Day. The whole world was a fool. God's got a sense of humor, too. I find this awesome. How do you find it? Now, then, don't you think a God who watches His Word like this, when you take hold of it, will watch His Word for His own sake? I claim the promise periodically. In the Old Testament, I am He that blotteth out thy sins for mine own sake, God speaking, not because of anything I deserve. Well, I leapfrog on that and recognize that to a sinning people, murmuring and complaining, after He had delivered them from Egypt's bondage and parted the Red Sea, not the way this past week's newspaper article tried to explain it by natural means, He rolled the waves back, and yet they were murmuring and complaining at the place where the bitter waters were sweetened. And in that context to sinning, undeserving people, God said concerning His nature, I'm the Lord that healeth thee. I therefore claim the promise that He watches His Word as I claim it. He'll heal me, and He'll heal you for His own sake, because He declared it as an attribute of His nature, I'm the Lord that healeth thee. Whatever promise you need, you grab it, knowing that the watcher of His Word watches you when you move into that eyesight of His Word with the same tenacity to carry His Word out. That's why I preach it. This message is over. Thank you for your prayers for me. It's offering time now.